The following is paid for by the Coalition for a Better Hollywood. For decades, Big Movie has had Hollywood studios in their back pocket. They spend millions to get you to spend billions on movies that are nothing more than sequels, reboots, remakes, reimaginings, Oscar cliche and January releases. Big movie lobbyists have all but ensured original film ideas are ignored, forgotten, or maybe not even real. Are they feature films? Are they quality flicks? Are they real motion pictures? Your soon-to-be, if not already favorite movie podcast stands with the little movies. Help put an end to Big Movie's cinematic censorship and listen to the pop-up film cast every Tuesday wherever honest hard-working podcasts can be found. We are the Pop-Up Film Cast, a proud member of the Podfix Network, and we support this message.
Hello and welcome to The Picture Show with Austin and Phil Rude. I am Phil Rude. I'm the dad.
I'm Austin Rude. I play the son. And every week we watch a movie and then we talk about it on this podcast that you listen to.
That's right. This very place.
This one.
On the internet. The crossroads of movies and nonsense? I don't know.
I mean, that kind of covers it. Movies, we're the nonsense, and then that those two things crossing.
Yeah, got it. Yeah. Okay.
Welcome.
Now we've settled that.
But first, we kind of talk about what we've done this week.
What have we done this week?
Good question.
Anything of substance? Anything of value? Anything worth talking about at all?
I don't know about you, but I never do anything of substance, if I can help it.
Well, I know that's true.
No, I don't know. It's been a week. I think the newest thing I've got going on is a new D&D campaign.
Ooh, cool.
Yeah, I play with some people you might know, because they're my
me
aunts and
or
uncles.
The audience?
You.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. No, I play with two of your siblings.
Yes.
Two of your in-laws and a few other people.
Cool.
Yeah. We started a new campaign and I'm excited. We started that last week and tonight is going to be our second week of it.
Nice.
And yeah, I don't know what to expect. We're looking for treasure. That's all I know.
Ooh, cool. Like pirates.
That's right.
Nice.
That's, other than that, I don't have much TV news or updates.
Yeah, I don't think I do either. I don't know if I watched anything this week. 90 Day Fiancé, of course, we're getting to the finale episodes of the season.
Look, you can't forget the classics.
I mean, sadly, I think that's probably all I've watched this week. A bunch of YouTube videos. I got my new computer this week. So I've been slowly setting that up and transferring things over to it. And
that's right. Can you guys feel it? This episode was edited on a smoother laptop.
A new laptop. Finally.
You can feel the minutes being shaved away from the recording time.
Old Toshiba satellite. We appreciate your years of long service and hard work. Thank you. We salute you.
You will be missed.
You will be missed. Anyway, now that we don't really have any news or anything.
Our lack of news covered.
What are
very
we,
short news day.
It's a light news day, you're right.
Yeah.
It's not much to it, but
well, that just leaves more room for what we're talking about this
what
week.
What are we talking about, Oz?
Well, this week we have 2013's Gravity. This movie stars Sandra Bullock as Dr. Ryan Stone and George Clooney as Matt Kowalski. Two astronauts stranded in space as a debris cloud wrecks havoc on their return to Earth. This movie is written by Alfonso and Jonas Cuarón. They're brothers, and directed by Alfonso Cuarón. And also, of course, I have to shout out the cinematography, which is done by Emmanuel Lubezki. I believe I'm pronouncing that right.
Lubezki. I will say you did better with Polish names than you do some of the more straightforward American names. I'm very, very surprised and impressed.
I don't know how spelling or grammar works.
There could be some Polish blood. I need a 23andMe to somehow you're like a Polish savant who,
my brain is 72% Polish.
The nine syllable ski, names just fall right into place for me.
The Germanic stuff I can get.
That's pretty
much good. Any other last name, I'm like completely lost.
Cinematography, I don't, man, I'm not trying to throw shade. Is it cinematography when everything is CGI?
I still think so. I still think it has to trick the eye.
It does have to trick the eye, but it's not the same as shooting with a camera. That's the only thing I'm saying. And I do think this is a case where like the tool sort of makes the difference. You're still creating maybe that's just an old way of thinking, because this movie does look amazing. Like the wide shots of the earth and space and like the northern lights and the sunrise and everything. I think it looks great.
Well, I think a lot of organizing, there is so much stuff in this movie, like the debris, you go inside a space station and there's like chess pieces flying around.
Right.
And, you know, someone has to make that CGI, but then they also got to figure out where to put it on the screen that's going to look pleasing. And
yeah, that's sort of my hang up with it is I feel like it's almost less of a director of photography and more of like an art director. You know what I mean? Like a director of photography is choosing the shots and shooting them.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to the artists who do the CGI. I don't know.
It's framing. It's just in a very different way.
In the same kind of way people talk about it, like mocap. Like,
Right.
Where's the actor credits, you know, past the voices? How much of a mocap performance is the animators? How much of it is the actor? How much of it is the voice actor? And where do we divide the credit up?
Right.
It's a weird sticking point, probably.
Well, but I think cinematography, that's like, standard is you're given a set, you kind of work out where in that space you want to frame things.
Right.
It's the same thing conceptually, but he's just doing it, like, he's got to think visually, like, in his own head, he's got to think, okay, where in space are they? Like, I don't know.
Right, yeah. But, yeah, I don't know. I don't know. We're getting in the weeds already.
Same job, different setting, I guess.
Different setting, but yeah, it is different when you're not photographing a real space and you have to work within the limitations of an actual space.
Yeah.
I have to get this city block in frame in a way that conveys this information, as opposed to, okay, I'll shoot the actors and then I'll just build everything around them. It's a different job.
He's drawing Earth with crayon, and then he's like looking at the director's proud parents.
I mean, it is different to approach it in that way. At the same time, like, I know that Pixar has hired director of photography to, you know, direct something that is completely made in, you know what I mean? The guy who shot No Country for Old Men shot a lot of stuff for the Coen brothers. Did like WALL-E and, you know, sort of directed the camera movement of that. So I'm just wondering what the correlation is. And I'm not trying to throw shade. If somebody has more information on what a cinematographer does and how that fits into its CGI space. Mm-hmm. I would love to hear about it.
Right. Neither of us works on movies.
Yeah,
right?
We're both idiots. So
that's definitely what I was trying to say.
I think the bottom line here is we don't know what we're talking about.
And, you should probably just shut this off because we don't even know.
Move on to the next topic.
What do we want to talk about next?
This is your show this week, buddy.
Oh, boy. And it's canceled. All right.
Wow.
No, let's talk about Sandra Bullock.
Let's do that.
Because we're with her 90% of the movie. She kind of is the movie.
Pretty much, yeah.
And, I mean, that's kind of how they treated her. I know, I read a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff.
Okay.
On Gravity, and, like, they had this special,
Can we start there with, I don't mean to pull you off topic here, but, like, you really like this movie.
I do.
Like,
yeah.
This is, I feel like this is a movie that, when it came out, everybody saw it, everybody talked about it and said how good it was, and a year later, nobody even remembered it happened.
Mm-hmm.
But this movie has stuck with you. You bought the DVD.
It's like James Cameron's Avatar.
Except it's rewatchable.
Well, right, but I mean, that one's more... one of those big things that this was a big movie because it was revolutionary CGI. Everyone wanted to see, the big space movie. But
I don't think it was. I don't think that's why people went to see
it. No?
I remember seeing this movie. This was our, me and your mom, this was our anniversary movie. We went out to dinner and then we go, well, let's go see a movie. And we just sort of, what's out? Oh, Gravity. That movie looks kind of cool. We went and saw it. The 3D stuff, I'm sure we saw it in 3D. But like, ooh, things are coming out at us. Like, all that stuff, whatever. Like, the thing that sells this movie is the building and relief of suspense. I don't think people were flocking because this was some big CGI spectacle. By 2013, we'd seen big CGI movies. Nobody cared anymore. I think this movie really is a good suspense thriller.
I think it is, too. I didn't think that was the big selling point.
I thought
it was the CGI.
I think maybe they tried to sell it on the CGI, but I don't think that's why people saw it. But it did seem weird to me, because I like this movie a lot, too.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed weird to me that everybody loved this movie and then just moved on from it. And it wasn't one of those that kind of stuck around in a way that people revisited. I'm trying to think of like an analog to that. Like, just in terms of like thrillers, like, and I know this was a long time before that, but like Silence of the Lambs is a movie that people still watch, still revisit, and still talk about how good it is.
Right. I think people even talk about like Interstellar more than... Like, yeah, I hear that brought up,
yeah.
But then people, like,
or
forgot
Inception,
about Gravity.
Any of the Christopher Nolan movies are like, ooh, what a phenomenon this is. I'm going to revisit this every couple of years. I'm going to buy this movie. I'm going to watch it every time it hits streaming. And for some reason, I feel like this is a movie that should have done that didn't. But it did stick with you.
Right. I love this movie. You guys need to get on it. Come on.
I agree. This is a really good movie. It's a very simple movie.
Not simply made, but yes, the
no,
plot
no,
of it.
Simply made. The plot of it and the themes of it are very bare bones and very simple. And I think that's why it works so well.
Right. You've got like... Okay, so here's how I think it goes down. Like... You want to tell a story in space. You want a big spectacle, big epic, you know, adrenaline, hype-up movie. But there needs to be a core there. And that's what Dr. Ryan Stone is. She is the core of this movie because her and her grief are, like, what propels the story.
Right.
We find out early on... that she's grieving the loss of her daughter. Right. I think she says she's five or
she's right. She something. Was four she, or five. Yeah.
Right. Very elementary young. School. Very tragic. It's one of the, that moment makes me cry every time she like, the way she tells the story is so.
It's very matter of fact. Very.
Right. I had a child.
Almost cold. Yeah. Yeah, this movie isn't about space. This movie is about dealing with grief. This movie is my perpetual looking for this in every movie. This movie is about Zen. This movie is about perspective. It's about acceptance. It's about reinventing yourself, and it's about survival.
Can you explain Zen? Because I kind of find that hilarious in this movie that tries as hard as it can to make you have a panic attack.
Right. But
how do you find Zen in that?
It's about being where you are, not being somewhere else. You know, she's spinning away at the very beginning when they first get hit by all that debris, right?
Yeah.
She's spinning out of control and panicking, freaking out. Oh my God, now I'm spiraling out into space. And George Clooney, Kowalski, is calming. You know, he's the calm one. He's the centered one. He's the one who says, okay, we have a series of problems. Let's focus on the immediate problem.
He's the veteran astronaut.
This is his last mission. Mm-hmm. And he is calm under pressure. And, you know, he's talking to her. He's solving the problem. He is moving forward. He's not hung up on the astronauts who died. Doesn't mean he doesn't care. It means he's in the moment right there.
He's let's focus on what's alive.
Let's fix the problem. Right. And that's what he's doing. As the movie progresses, she slowly starts to come into that space. When he leaves the movie, she is kind of reborn as him. She takes on more of his traits. And that happens like two or three times. There's like three rebirth sequences in this movie where she each time comes out a little bit stronger, a little bit newer, a little bit more in charge. And as that happens, she is more and more focused on moving forward. Mm-hmm. That what she, where she is back with her daughter.
Right.
She's never moved on from her daughter dying or even dealt with that.
She went to space and she's still in this mindset of I'm just driving. I'm just moving along.
She's escaping the grief. Mm-hmm. In any way that she can find to do it.
Look, you can go as far as you want. Your daughter's still going to be dead in space. I hate to be the one to you.
It's true. That is what the movie is about. It's about the fact of the matter is your daughter is dead. You get to keep living. And that's that's a very bare bones way to look at it. But that's what the movie is saying is like, you can keep living. And by the end of the movie, she is accepting when she's, it's almost, I think, trite, but when she is getting ready to re-enter the atmosphere and she's talking to Kowalski and saying, please go find my daughter. I think that is so emotional and so empowering and so kind of beautiful in its... It's cliche. It's tropey.
It's one of the cheesiest things that like, it's like, this is a character talking out loud to a character that isn't there. Like that always feels forced and it doesn't. I'm just like invested at this point.
It's one of those things like the end of season one of the OA where it's lame and cheesy and also emotional at the same time. You know
what
I mean?
We're going to break dance to stop a bullet. Sure. Yes.
Right, it is that, but I like it, and I like the journey that her character goes on in this.
I think You said there's multiple rebirths, but I think there's a reason for that, because, like...
There's definitely a reason for
cause,
it, yeah.
Because she starts out... it's funny, because when they go to the ISS, Clooney is literally pulling her. He's tugging her on a rope.
Right.
And then it ends up with him letting go, and she has to carry on using his momentum. But that runs out. And then she's just left alone, and she needs to find a reason to fight for herself.
Right.
Not for her daughter, not for him, but for herself. And that scene where she just shuts off all the power.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And she just gets ready to die in space.
Yeah.
But then she doesn't. At this point, I'm just narrating the movie.
Well, she doesn't because... you know, the ghost of Kowalski talks sense into her.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Which is really her talking sense
right.
into her.
Right.
All
the information's coming from her.
Right. It is the internal God. That's what all of that is. And that's like her internal, you know, that's what keeps coming around. And yes, I am looking for it. So I, you know.
Right.
You find what you're looking for, essentially. But
that's all this
stuff. That's what the Zen is. That's what all of this stuff is like. She is focusing on the moment. And, mm-hmm. and she sort of becomes more centered as the movie goes on. And it's really like, it's a beautiful thing to watch in the midst of like this high octane, like insanity that's going on around her.
Right.
You know? I have talking about the ISS, I wanted to just point out, like, that's the most obvious, like, rebirth sequence when she gets into there.
Yeah, it shows Earth behind her. She's cradled like a baby in the womb.
Right, it is a fetal position. There's, like, little cord. It even looks like umbilical cords running through there.
So deliberate.
And then when she leaves the airlock, she goes through this tunnel. You know, which is like, oh, she's being birthed into... But when she... It's very obvious. It's very... I think it would... I think a cynical viewer would say, that's too obvious and I don't like it. But I'm like, there's nothing... I don't think there's anything wrong with being obvious. With not hiding your meaning. Everything doesn't have to be 2001. You know what I mean?
Right. And even 2001 doesn't always try to be subtle, because that's not the goal of movies.
Exactly. It's communicating something in a kind of poetic way.
Right.
But you notice when she is reborn, she is slightly more in charge. You know, she's starting to take things into her own hands. She's starting to take charge of her situation and realize that she has to be the one to fix everything.
Right. I at one point, she even goes, what now? Like,
yeah.
Oh, there's a fire? Okay, I guess I'll deal with that.
Dude, when she blasts it with the fire extinguisher and, like, almost knocks herself out.
Yeah, that's like, a real thing in
space.
Yeah,
yeah. It's,
dangers in this movie. I saw Wally.
Yeah.
Yes.
They run with a fire extinguisher outside. Yeah, let's take a break, and then we'll come back and get into this movie a little bit deeper.
Dad, that's enough. I need some space, okay?
I'll float away.
All right.
Very quietly.
Never let go.
Let me turn on my country music and just float off into space.
Kowalski, come back.
Hi, this is Mouse.
I'm Weens.
We have the Mouse and Weens podcast.
Mouse and Weens.
I'm a big sister in San Diego with kids, and I'm married.
And I have no friends. No, I'm just kidding. No, I do. I have friends. I just don't have any boyfriends or love. Anyway, Mouse and Weens podcast. You should listen to it.
Yeah, it's
not
really
depressing.
Fun. We talk about family stories, life and love, and kids, and all the things you're interested in. We promise.
Yay!
Celebrities in Hollywood, too.
Poke your little turtle head out and come listen to us.
Mouse and Weens. Bye.
Hey, this is Kate. I'm a forensic psychologist and crisis clinician, and I collect stories. Everything from true crime to trauma to parenthood. There's a lot more in common between depression and sociopathy, or between serial killers and podcasters, than you might think. Are you sure you really want to know? This is Ignorance Was Bliss at iwbpodcast.com and iwbpodcast on social media.
And we are back.
Welcome back.
Welcome back, Austin. How was your break?
It's good.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'm back here on Earth. I've got everything I needed to do done.
Good for you. Yeah. Good job.
And I still have my daughter.
Wow. I didn't even know you had a daughter.
Take that, Ryan Stone.
Wow.
I'm sorry.
All right. Where do we want to go on this? Sandra Bullock. You started talking about Sandra Bullock. Do you want to talk about her performance?
I actually don't know what else I know her from. This, and I think that Ocean's movie she did.
She did. Ocean's 8, yep.
Those are the two things that stand out in my mind. But, like, the making of this movie was brutal. So, the fact that she even, like, just showed up to work every day, and then the fact that she's really good in it, blows my mind. But, like, They invented like this metal wire ball contraption that she had to sit in for like 17 hours a day, doing CGI scenes. They called it, what was it? It was like Sandra's hamster ball or something. And
oh,
like,
really?
Yeah, they ended up that the crew would like throw a party every morning, like, just to, like, she's here, she's ready, because they knew how much hell this was for her.
Just to pump up her getting into the... So yeah. Was it, like, a thing that they could move around, and then it CGI'd out the ball, so that she would...
It's like this suspension wire cage that goes around her, and okay. It can kind of rotate. Yeah, it's all edited out. It's how she floats.
Interesting. I thought they did the vomit comet thing again, but...
Oh, no. That... I mean, for this movie, they would have to fly that thing, like, a billion times.
Yeah, well,
because
what you pay for.
It was basically cheaper to invent a new way of CGI.
Interesting.
To do this hour-and-a-half movie or something.
Do know her from Bird Box.
That's right.
I'm
not her best work, but
I still have not seen it, but
I think you have, Dad. I think me and you watched like 30 minutes of it.
I didn't finish it.
I saw it through.
Sandra Bullock has done some real garbage movies, but
you know what that means? She's getting paid.
It does mean she's getting paid. I also think that despite that, Sandra Bullock is pretty good. I think she has some real standout movies and some real standout performances, but I'm always like a little bit like, how did you end up in, I'm just looking at her filmography. There's a lot of, and it's not even just like the rom-coms, but, just some, you know, some real crap, you know, but I feel like she's a better actress than that. I think she's capable of doing like some really incredible roles. I don't know, like this one. I think this is a great fit for her. And I don't think her filmography. I'm sound like I'm coming down really hard, but like her low points are like low.
You know what I mean? You're just a teacher in like a parent teacher conference who's like, I see the potential Sandra has. She could get A's.
That is what I'm talking about. Like, I mean, come on. Did she need to do Miss Congeniality 2, Armed and Fabulous?
Everyone needed to do that movie.
She probably got a good payday out of that, I'm sure. But, yeah, she's in a movie called Gunshy that was like, where she's a cop. And it's one of those movies that like, oh, this is a good movie that like nobody saw. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But then she was in something like The Net, which everybody saw before everybody had.
Was that like the horror cyberspace?
It's like a weird like internet, her life was ruined by hackers kind of thing.
Okay. It was before everybody had internet in their home and knew how it all worked. But,
before Black Mirror was...
Oh, way before. Yeah. I mean, early on, Demolition Man, Speed.
Speed is something. I know that.
Speed is really good. Then she did, like, Speed 2. Not as good. But I know she did Speed 2 because it was one of those things where the studio told her, you can make whatever movie you want, but you have to make a Speed sequel for us.
Right. And they had her under contract,
I think she made Hope Floats off of that, which, yeah, it's fine. Practical Magic is actually a really fun movie about witches that I feel like kind of came and went and people didn't see it. But yeah, she's a really good actor.
Have you seen her in Oceans?
Yeah, I saw Ocean's 8.
Okay, yeah.
Ocean's 8 is fine.
I don't know. She does the conniving badass.
She's okay.
Really well.
Yeah, she's good in that. I didn't put that together. Her and Clooney in this movie together.
Is Clooney in Oceans?
He's Danny Ocean from Ocean's 11.
He's apparently her brother. Her brother, yeah.
There's a weird connection there. But I think she's a better actor than her filmography tells you she is.
Yeah.
I think that's what I'm trying to say. Like,
and I think people know that. I think when you say the name Sandra Bullock,
I think so. Yeah. But this is an example of, I think, something, an example of her work that I think is sort of above the cut. It's one of her better outings, and I think she's really good in this.
I think so too. Do you want to talk about, we have this a few times on our notes, Point of View?
Hate it.
Yeah. This movie, look, I'm going to call out the director again, Alfonso Cuarón.
Alfonso Cuarón, yep.
He is so good. Like, this movie, there's so much time and effort and, like, passion put into this, but my god, is it just like nauseating at points.
Yeah,
and at points it's meant to be, but there are points where it's completely unnecessary. There is a 13 minute single opening shot to this movie, and I didn't know that until someone told me, because like this movie, it doesn't matter if it's single point or not, because it's
talking about the like the unbroken shot.
Yeah, it's unbroken, but like with CGI, that doesn't matter. It doesn't help in immersion. It's just kind of like this look to say I did it.
I feel like and Alfonso Cuarón, he made a movie called Children of Men, which is freaking incredible. David and I talked about it on Brokeback Mountain. There's a couple points in there, but one of them is a very famous, like, unbroken shot that takes place in a car, and the camera kind of goes around, you know, this couple, and it's this long shot, and there's a couple of, like, long unbroken shots that follow people around, and I feel like he got some acclaim for that, and he's like, oh, I'm gonna do this all the time now.
Yeah, probably.
I got him, I need to look it up, the guy who directed Birdman and The Revenant.
Oh, isn't Birdman like a single, like the idea is it's one shot the whole movie?
Alejandro Iñárritu is the director of that. Yes, it's not one shot, but it's presented as it, yes. Like there's a few places where like the camera goes around a wall or around a corner or something, and that's where they break the shot, but it is presented as one shot. The Revenant, he did The Revenant as well, and The Revenant is full of long single take shots that follow action going, and it's really cool. It's a really cool effect.
It is.
But also, yeah, there are a couple points in this movie that just seemed self-indulgent. You know,
that's the word for it.
Yes.
Because it's not, there are parts in this movie where it's like, okay, yes, you're trying to disorient me.
Right.
She's flying through space. Of course, you're going to rotate the camera.
Right.
But when you have 13 minutes for no reason of one shot or...
And there and a couple other points, like when Clooney starts towing her, you know, they uh-huh. tether each other. And there's just like these long shots of them floating through. And it just...
That I actually like.
I like it. It looks beautiful, but it's not advancing the story. And it actually kind of, I think, stalls the pacing of this movie in a couple spots. Not terrible. Mm-hmm. It doesn't take me completely out of it, but there were a couple points where they were doing that and then something would happen and I would go, oh, my mind was wandering a little bit. Like, it's like you're just getting a little bit long, and it all does, it feels self-indulgent. Like, we got this cool shot of the sunrise coming over the earth. Isn't it cool? And yeah. they really want you to see it. And I think it just lingers a little bit too long. But it's in that same token of the 13-minute opening unbroken shot. It's like,
yeah.
It's like, yeah, we get it.
And then
we get what you're doing.
And then there's like the showing the inside of the helmet or...
That's the stuff I really hate.
Yeah.
Because I don't like first-person shooters. And I think in this movie, it was trying... Everything was from her perspective, and I got that. I didn't need to see things through her eyes as well.
Yeah.
I
this isn't a story about me. This is a story about her, and I recognize that.
Right.
You've already given me reason to care about her. I don't need to pretend I'm there to care. I don't know. It just feels like almost like an extra precaution.
Almost just like they took this idea just a little bit too far. Just over the line to what we needed.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I did think like, and I think here's a good example of it. When they first are zooming in on her and she's like breathing really hard, there's a point where it goes inside her helmet. It's still focused on her face, but it like it breaks the glass of her helmet.
Yeah,
you know the camera.
It like absorbs through her.
Right. It's like now we're in on her. Like and that works. But then they take it a step too far and shift it into her what she's seeing, and it's like no. You had me when you brought it inside the helmet, and you brought me up close and personal with her, and that was it. And then they just took it just that little half step too far, I think.
They gave her that Iron Man helmet with the specs and all that.
It's got the heads-up display on it, yeah.
I did
Which
like...
Which was really... That is actually really cool that I didn't think was a thing.
That is a real thing. I do like that they show... The only reason I like that is because they show, like, oh, you can see the oxygen. But, like, even then, like, she tells you, hey, I'm at this level of oxygen. I'm gonna... start breathing slowly.
Yeah, that was cool.
There's a few more things I want to talk about. Mainly the sound of this movie. The music is really good in itself. You touched on that when you said that it kind of kicks in your adrenaline. There's a lot of action scenes. But like...
And they know when to play the music. They know when to keep it quiet and have it silent and when to kick it on.
That's right. But this movie is about space, and you don't hear a lot of space sounds to it because as humans and as moviegoers, we're just not accustomed to it. So instead, this movie uses sounds that we're familiar with. The inside of ships, they're using like the sound of... ships on water, like submarines and cargo ships, and like the creaking of they have that on the inside. And then for outside shots, they even have like there's a part in this movie where the debris cloud is coming and you can hear like boom it's starting to rip through different stuff, and it sounds like a rainstorm, like an approaching rainstorm. And I think that's very deliberate. It could be just me reading into things, but like,
no, that makes sense. Like danger, like the storm yeah. coming. Like, yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. The one sound thing that stuck out to me, aside from like when it would just be like dead silent, which I really like, is like she starts having a freak out in that pod and starts like wailing on it.
Yeah.
And just the dead thuds you hear outside the ship. And I realize like in space you wouldn't actually hear anything. But like just that, you know, you see her through the window and just hear that very, very faint, like, you know, like that.
It's very satisfying.
It is. But I also like there's a point in it, I think it's when she's at the ISS, when the debris is coming and she's trying to get inside and you see it behind her. You don't hear it necessarily, but you mm-hmm. see the debris start to come through and shred everything behind her.
Yeah, and it's like sharp, like you hear the wind of it, even though there's no wind.
It's such a cool effect to see it like increase, you know, like first it's one or two pieces and then, all hell is breaking loose.
Because I think this movie would suck if you did, we got to do it accurate and it's just silence.
The idea of like accurate space movies, super accurate military or submarine movies. It's like, you got to take some license here because you're conveying information. This isn't a documentary. Like, you know what I mean? And
there's totally. A story to tell.
Exactly.
And another thing I noticed about music is there's a really cool part. It's when Matt is drifting away, and you hear he turns back on his music. He turns
his music on, yeah.
And his music plays, but like, you know, when there's...
The score is still going.
Right, yes. It's separate from the score, and the score plays with it in such a way,
it still kind of meshes in an, you know...
It's so bizarre, I've never heard that, where a movie is, or music is integrated into the plot. But then the score is separate from it, and it still elicits emotional value. Like, that country song turned sad somehow when it wasn't sad before.
It's, there's something about, it doesn't sound discordant. There's something about it must be in the same key or something to make it all mesh. Mm-hmm. But it's two completely different styles of music. Somehow, they fit together in not a really great way, but a really interesting way. Mm-hmm. It doesn't sound bad. It doesn't turn you off to anything.
It sounds like someone's phone's going off.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
you don't realize it's playing.
That's,
yeah.
That's really something. Yeah, that's cool. And also, like, I like that he drifts away and he's still, like, calm. He's just accepted, like, I'm going to die in space. Mm-hmm. Like, that... And he's... Despite that, he's still trying to calm her down. He's telling her what to do, how to survive. And just the fact that he's getting staticky more and more as he drifts away and she's losing the signal. It's so haunting and it's kind of beautiful at the same time. Like he's very calming. In talking to her. You should see the sunrise coming over these mountains on this side of the earth. And it's just... and he's just sort of drifting off to his fate. It's really wild.
Yeah, and he stays with that goal of, like... forget about the dead. We're focusing on the living. This is our goal. And then he sees himself drift off and he's like, okay, I'm dead. Now I'm helping her.
Yep.
Now this is the new goal, and that's what
she does. She is going to be the survivor of this, and of course she was. So, yeah.
And then, here's the thing. Just realized, if Clooney, if his character is like that for her, it makes, like, no wonder at the end of the movie, she's like, this is my daughter's name. She was looking for her red shoe. Go tell her. Like, go be what you were to me. To her, now that you're dead.
Yeah, she knows that he'll be comforting to her daughter as
Even in the afterlife, that's his role. Yeah. I think that's comforting.
I like that red shoe bit. I think that's why that tropiness of that moment doesn't bother me. Because, like, that's a real kid-parent moment.
That's such a small detail.
The big freak out over the thing that doesn't matter at all. Like, and working in a school, I can tell you. I mean, that's a real, like, parent moment. There's the M. Night Shyamalan movie, Signs. There's the scene... naysayers, go away. I love Signs. I think Signs is a great movie. There's the scene at the end when they're having their last meal. And the aliens are trying to get in the house. And Joaquin Phoenix is, you know, doing that last minute boarding things up. And Mel Gibson is taking his kids and telling them stories about their mom, telling them how they were born, and, you know, all of these, like, beautiful little... And I think they are based on, like, M. Night Shyamalan's kids. You know, he brought these real-life moments with his kids into this movie, and it sells it so well. You're like... Yes.
As like these a distraction are little, thing.
These
that's
are
like...
not just the distraction thing, but like, yes, these are little things that parents remember about their kids. These things that, you know, he's like, oh, when you were born, you didn't make a sound. You didn't cry. You didn't do anything. And it was the most like miraculous calm thing I've ever seen, you know, like, and it's the sort of like that's a parent moment. And I think if you can pepper that into your script, you can sell a real moment with a kid.
Can I say it's funny because you're right. I've seen it in a bunch of stuff. Like, I have examples I can think of. But when you really get down to it, it's like that stuff isn't original, but it feels original because that's like something interpersonal.
It feels real.
That you do with your child. Yes. And then it's like, no other kid does that, but it's like every kid does that. So every parent can relate.
Parents relate and parents can, even if that's not the case with their kid, I think parents can recognize a legitimate parent-kid moment or parent experience.
Yes.
Like when you're watching something or reading something and a character goes, what do you want me to do? I'm a single working mother. It's like, okay, people don't talk like that. People don't spout out their demographic in that way.
Hello, I'm a black gay woman from the 40s. Right. Nice to meet you.
Like,
what?
You know, it's just sort of like, oh, you're just ticking boxes and dropping exposition as opposed to actually throwing a character experience out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think that this movie does this, Gravity does this so well, because that's what Sandra Bullock does. Her character tells a story about her daughter dying and how she copes with it or avoids coping with it. And she tells that story in a pretty natural way. You know, she says, I had a daughter. You know, it slowly comes out.
The information, it's not all at once.
Right.
It's disorganized.
And it happens she only tells because Kowalski asks, and he only asks to keep her calm. It all is organically sewn into the story.
Because it's not like you go, hey, coworker.
Hey.
When did your daughter die?
Tell me about your dead kid. Like, no, that's not how these things work. Mm-hmm. Like... It sells it in a way that is super real, that I think people can hear and sympathize with and take it as a real moment as opposed to something forced into the script,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense.
You know, another real moment in this movie is the radio scene. Where she gets on the radio with another person, someone who
the
does
guy
not
in Asia, yeah.
He doesn't even speak the same language as her, and they bond over the sound of dogs.
The dogs. That is such a cool scene. In watching it again, I'm like, it starts out ridiculous, and when she finally gives in to just howling with the dogs, I'm like, this is somehow a really cool, this is really working for me. I can't even picture why it worked for me so well.
It's so human to see someone
bond with a dog.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
But not even that, like, she is imitating a dog. Like, that's ridiculous, right? But it's something she shouldn't be doing in this situation. Like, she's fighting for her life, but she's doing it anyway, and that's what makes her human.
She's having a human experience. And you kind of get a sense that, space aside, she has not probably had many of those since her kid died. You know, like, she's been hiding in her car and in her work. And then, like, the baby comes on the, you know, she hears the baby crying on the radio.
Oh, new life.
And it's just it inspires the whole cycle. Yeah, it's great. It's a great scene.
Yeah. By the way, fun fact, the co-author of this movie, he has a short story that features that man with the radio.
Oh, really?
It's this bizarre crossover, but, like, he basically wrote a short story, and then they were writing this movie, and his brother was like, I'm gonna include your character, and he just did it.
This is like the Nolan brothers. He's like the Jonathan Nolan of this duo.
Does he do that?
Christopher Nolan, his writing partner is often Jonathan Nolan, his brother. And Memento is actually based on a short story that Jonathan Nolan wrote.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
I guess that is like that.
And then Jonathan Nolan made Westworld and got mad that people figured it out and decided he was going to throw a fit and make an indecipherable story from there on out. But,
I'm glad we don't have any bad blood over that situation.
Of the Nolan brothers, I think he's the lesser. But speaking of Westworld, I have a fun fact as well. Ed Harris is in this movie. He is the voice of Mission Control.
Ah, Houston.
Houston, yes. And Ed Harris played Gene Kranz, head of Mission Control in Apollo 11.
Hey,
so
he works for NASA a lot then.
He also plays John Glenn in The Right Stuff, another space movie about the Mercury astronauts.
That's, I think Disney Plus has that.
Do they really?
I've seen an ad for that or something.
Oh, we may be watching a 4-hour space movie.
That is the coolest thing you've ever said.
Oh, The Right Stuff is great. That's going to happen.
Okay, now I can't even think about... I had more to say.
No, this is your show, man.
I don't know. Gravity is amazing. It really is. I like it both for the imagery, the accurate space stuff, and just for, like... There really is something... I don't know what it is, but, like... Like, the concept of, like, a parent losing a child is, like, the most horrific thing that's never happened to me, but it always, like...
Sure.
...grabs me very deeply. Like, there's, in Glee, one of the characters dies, and there's a scene where his mom is crying over it, and she says, I don't get a son, but I still have to be a mother or something. Like, she still has to...
Yeah, I don't. I can't.
It's just
speak
this heartbreaking Glee. Concept.
It's a thing that I think universally everybody understands. That everybody understands the tragedy, but also understands that you can't understand what that feels like, and you hope you never have to experience. I know people who have lost children, and I don't ever even know what to say, because there's nothing that can really, I mean, it's every parent's worst fear, you know, it is, I think it is just universally understood that this is an unspeakable, tragic thing that a lot of people have to deal with. And this, I don't think this movie is focused on what form the tragedy takes. This movie is just about, like, when something traumatic happens to you, you have two choices. You can go on living, or you can stop and stay physically alive, but emotionally you can die too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and it's sort of making the argument of like, living doesn't mean, you know, going on with your life doesn't mean that you're moving on from that memory.
Yeah.
And I think there is a depth that to the message in this movie that it is saying that.
I think you're right that like what she's grieving, like that doesn't matter in itself to the story. Like this could be about her 28-year-old son that died in a motorcycle accident.
Or her parents. Or
right.
It could be about a divorce. I mean, mm-hmm. People shut down over all kinds of big traumatic life events.
Right. So if you're going to make a movie about grief, why not just pick
something that is universally understood.
Something everyone can relate to, and something she fell and hit her head. Like, it's so simple. Like,
right.
You don't have to explain right. The mechanics
there's,
of how
there's this... no one to blame. This wasn't a drunk driver. This wasn't, you know,
it was just a
freak accident and a huge tragedy. Exactly. It's something everybody, I think a lot of people understand, like, yes, if there was one thing that could get me to shut down, it would be this. They sort of package the worst of it
mm-hmm.
in, I don't want to say a simple form, but as sort of a driver for the character and why the character is the way the character is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's fair.
I think that's a really good analysis of it.
And I also wanted to say, I don't know if I said this already, so I'll just say it again. I think the reason this movie is about grief is because like the message is saying is to keep moving on, to keep going.
Keep moving.
But that's also a theme that's inherent to space. You know, we think of it, it's the final frontier. It's we're moving forward, we're advancing. We're in this movie, she's hopping from
station
to station. I mean, that's what we've done. The International Space Station is the most expensive thing humanity has ever built.
And they trashed it.
Well, no, but fun story. We're going to have to trash it in 10 years.
No, I mean, it got trashed in this movie.
Oh, well, yes.
The Hubble, the space shuttle, the All ISS, of it. Everything just smashed.
This biopic from 2013.
Way to go, Russians. You couldn't nuke your own satellite without destroying everything up there.
We're not that far off with Space Force.
Hey,
we'll see. But yeah, we're always building new space stations. We had one before the ISS, and it burned up just like the one at the end of this movie. Mm-hmm. In the atmosphere.
It's a great sequence, by the way.
It is. There was so much mold growing on the inside between the walls that it was a hazard.
Yeah.
That they were just like, okay, this thing, we launched
they
it.
You got to bring the remediation guys up there on a shuttle so they can put the big dryers in there and clean it out.
What they really need is a trash night so that they can go in and
clear
out the leftovers.
Drag everything out to the curb and leave it out there for the trash guys to pick up.
But yeah, space, we're always reinventing, moving forward. So I think grief was kind of like the perfect metaphor for this movie.
Yeah. Also, like the idea that she was hiding from her problems in the same way that we go to space to avoid dealing with the problems we have on Earth. We just go,
very true.
Let's go to space and then we won't have to worry about how terrible our environment is. We can just go fuck up another planet.
Hell yeah.
So, yeah.
Once we learn how to terraform Mars, we can just...
we can go screw up Mars now. Hey, Matt Damon, come grow some potatoes for us. I will
different
say,
movie.
Different movie, but also about survival in a unsurvivable environment.
Yeah.
It might be a good double feature if you want to have a heart attack. Watch two terrifying space survival stories back to back.
You know what? I think this is better than The Martian.
Ooh,
they're
so, very different. Yes,
they're different in like their execution.
Yes,
as to like tone wise, that's the main difference. And I think so. Yeah. I like the tone of this better. I think.
The Martian is more of like a straight adventure story.
Yeah. And I mean, he's still like in a life or death situation, but a little more casual.
It's different. Yeah. He has a house. Yeah. He has solid ground. Yeah. He has gravity somehow, because Ridley Scott just didn't want to build a giant hamster wheel that did that. But, oh, that's cool. Thanks for bringing this movie and making me rewatch it. I haven't seen it in a long time. And I think that's what made it so baffling that people forgot that, like, sometimes you revisit a movie and you go, like Avatar. You revisit Avatar and you go, what were we so hyped about? This movie's like, no big deal. But Gravity, I rewatch it and I go, oh, this is super fun. This is a super good movie. Still, like, I don't know why people left this movie in 2013 when they did, but...
It's bizarre.
Let's go out on a limb and recommend that people revisit or watch it for the first time. I think this is a great movie that's really worth your time.
If you haven't watched this, you need to.
It's not even that long, is it? Hour and a half?
It's two hours? It's under 2 hours.
Yeah, it's under.
I would say it's definitely under. Hour and a half.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And aside from those couple spots I was complaining about, it never stops moving.
No, because it's always this intense.
The clock's literally ticking. She sets the timer on her watch, and
quick story about this. The music in this movie, because I write and I like to listen to soundtracks, so I like compile different playlists.
Right. That's a good idea.
And I was coming up with the sci-fi one, and I was thinking of movies, and so I thought of Gravity, and I went to add the soundtrack. I can't write when I'm listening to this music, because it's just so intense.
It's pretty intense, yeah.
I'm like too caught up in something's coming at me.
This was Stephen Price is the composer of this. He won an Academy Award for this score.
Well deserved.
He also did the score for a cool movie called Attack the Block. He did the score for Baby Driver. What else we got here? Pirate Radio. Ooh, Mr. Bean's Holiday. Nice. But that's on the... This guy does some cool stuff.
Yeah, I think, wow, this and Baby Driver. That's I think that's all you need for a resume.
Baby Driver is pretty sweet, yeah. Just weird to think about that movie having a score, because it's
95% playlist.
It's built on on pop music, but that's cool. Let's close this out and move on to shoutouts.
All right, let's bring it back down to earth.
Back down to earth. What do you got this week, Oz?
All right, my shout out is a little weird this week. I am introducing people to the rap song My Pen Is.
I get it.
Delete the space and you'll be as smart as us. Yes, it is a dick joke.
Thanks.
It is by Mikey Angelo. He's like a Gen Z TikTok rapper, which, yes, that is a thing. And most of them I would disregard. But this song caught me off guard. Like, it plays with, I think the main thing, he's really good, like, prose and, like, what's the word for how you say words? Like, enunciation? Like meter? Meter, yeah.
Like the...
Cadence.
Yeah.
Okay. Cadence is the word. He has such great cadence, and his lyrics are, like, very clever. A lot of the, like, puns rely on pop culture references, but... I don't see that as a deterrent.
No.
So he's not for everyone, but like, I would recommend check it out. I'm not even very into rap, and his song got me hyped.
Cool.
So yeah, that's...
My Pen Is Mikey Angelo.
That's right. He also goes by...
Michelangelo?
I don't know. He also goes by Mr. Grande. Very, very funny.
Cool.
All right, what do you have?
I should have brought this up last week. I have another album I want to shout out. This is Bob Schneider. He's a singer-songwriter out of Austin, Texas. Last week I shouted out Clint Wells, and Clint Wells used to be a guitar player for Bob Schneider. So, and they do a podcast together. So it's all connected. Bob Schneider has an album from, he has a new album coming out, but he has an album from a few years ago called King Kong, including a song about King Kong and how tragic it is that he just wants to love somebody.
It is tragic.
But yeah, King Kong is really a good album. It's a lot of ballads on it, and it's like a double album. So check that out, Spotify, whatever. I recommend Bob Schneider to a lot of people who like singer, songwriter kind of rock music.
Right.
I think he's really interesting. He makes a lot of interesting kinds of music, and he's really just a prolific songwriter.
If it's a lot of ballads, that sounds more like the Peter, what's his face version of King Kong rather than
Peter Jackson.
Skull Island. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a little less romantic for
it's about a guy who feels like King Kong.
All right. But yeah, I'll take it.
That's it. Bob Schneider, King Kong. And you can get that wherever you get music.
Wherever you get your King Kongs.
That's right. Wherever you get your giant apes. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Picture Show with Austin and Phil Rude. If you enjoy our show, please leave a review on your podcatcher of choice. It really helps our visibility, and it helps us grow the show.
That's right. Another way to help us grow is to tell a friend. Anyone you know who's a movie fan, or a space fan, or a fan of people named Philip.
Ooh.
That's right.
Good call.
Just Philip, no Austin fans. Texas can have them. But yeah, tell them about us and our dumb puns.
Please. More puns.
That's right. What do you have for us to watch next week?
Next week, we are going into the world of Miyazaki. I am not well versed in this world. I've only seen a couple of movies, and I have for a long time wanted to check more of them out. So we are going to watch My Neighbor Totoro, or Totoro. I've heard it both ways. I'm sure I'll be corrected still, but we're gonna watch it.
My neighbor is actually Ned Flanders.
I didn't know how. Yeah, we're going to check it out. If you have HBO Max, it is on there. It's Miyazaki section.
Yeah, they've got the collection.
So, yeah, I'm wanting to dive in more, whether we do them for the podcast or not. But I thought we'd kick it off with this and give it a shot.
That is going to be interesting. That's one of those things that I don't have nostalgia for because I never watched. There's so many people that are like, this is my comfort thing.
It's a very, it is a very dedicated fan base. I mean, I think it's huge in Japan,
and
but there's like a subset of American fandom for it. And it's, I think it's always intimidated me and kind of kept me out of it.
My initial thoughts on Miyazaki is that he's very zen. And very, like, mystical, spiritual stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot of...
which, honestly, that's weird that you...
Supernatural kind of stuff, yeah.
That you weren't more into that you haven't done the deep dive.
Yeah, I've seen Howl's Moving Castle, which is great. I've seen Ponyo that I didn't really care for.
See, that's the one I've seen...
Yeah.
And it went kind of in and out.
Yeah, it didn't really stick with me, but I did see Howl's Moving Castle, and that was a point, too, where I was like, I'm going to watch more Miyazaki stuff, and I never did, so now that it's all on HBO, I really want to make more time for it, and this is an easy way for me to kick that off, so...
Well, that's good.
Let's watch it, and dive in to the waters of Miyazaki.
Dive on in.
Austin... Throw your social media handles out there. Let the people know where to find you.
All right. I am Austin N. Rude and The Old Who Review on Twitter. And on TikTok, I am Austin N. Rude.
Cool.
That's me.
PhilRude.com. You can get all our episode information and whatever else I'm drawing and writing and whatnot there. At Phil Rude on Twitter, at PhilRude75 on Instagram.
You want to talk about what you showed up on this week?
I'll talk about, I guested on a podcast, and I'll just shout it out real quick because you teased it. It's called Not Just Heather, and it is Heather Welch from Sunshine and Power Cuts. She has a new show out. I guested on it. I will be making more noise about that when the episode actually drops.
Okay, I assumed it was on the same.
But go check that out anyway. Schedule. Heather is awesome. Check out Sunshine and Power Cuts 2. It has not updated for a while, but it's super interesting. And her new shows are really worth your time. She's a really cool person who knows other really cool people, and she knows me too. So check that out. Austin, you want to read the credits?
Yeah, we do everything ourselves.
Well, there you have it. We'll see you next time on The Picture Show.
See ya.